On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training on phytotechnologies. Today's training was developed by the ITRC Phytotechnology Revision Team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Roxboro, North Carolina. I'm going to serve as a moderator on today's call. I'm going to cover introductory material in the next few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our instructors from the ITRC Phytotechnology Team. As listed on the slide, today's training course is based on the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance and Decisions Trees, the revised phytotechnology document, Phyto-3. Today's training is an introduction to this document, and we do encourage you to review the document itself. At the end of the training, we'll take you to a link where you can download a copy of the document. We also make available the presentation that you'll see during today's training. In addition to what you'll see on the slides throughout the course today, there's more information in the speaker's notes section of the downloaded version. And again, at the end of the training, we'll take you to the links so that you can access both the document and the presentation. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, CLUIN. Please move to slide 2. If you're using the CLUIN system, it's the series of orange buttons along the top that allow you to navigate, and most often you use the third button, the single right arrow, to move forward through the presentation. Today's course is scheduled for 2.25 hours. For our phone line participants, a reminder, do not put the call on hold. Also, it is *6 that's going to allow you to mute, and then it toggles back to unmute. So at the question and answer breaks, if you're on the phone line, you're welcome to ask questions out loud. And we'll remind you again at that time how to ask questions. For our simulcast audience, you're also welcome to ask questions. It's the question mark button at the top of the slide that's going to allow you to send in questions. Anyone is welcome to use that throughout today's presentation to send in a comment or a question. If you are having trouble with the CLUIN site, you may need to turn off pop-up blockers. As we move through the slides today, each of you in the audience are in control of what slide you're on. The slide number is in the upper left-hand corner, and the instructors are going to say it throughout the presentation. If you're using CLUIN, you can use a series of buttons along the top to navigate. There's also a list of slide numbers along the left, and that's especially useful during the question and answer breaks. You can jump back to a specific slide and then come back forward with the rest of us. On the last slide, we have a link to our feedback form, and we do ask that everyone on the call take just a few minutes at the end of the class to fill out our feedback form. We are recording today's event, and we offer archives of ITRC training classes, and I've listed the link on this slide where you can access them. On slide 3, this slide includes the ITRC disclaimer and copyright. We included this information in all ITRC training presentations and ask that you please read over the slide. In short, it says we've tried to provide accurate and reliable information, but do not warranty this material. We recommend you check with local, state, federal laws, as well as experts. ITRC does not endorse any specific products. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted, so please ask permission before using. On slide 4, you can go to the ITRC website to learn more about ITRC. Overall, ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators and includes federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC addresses a wide variety of topics, and the teams communicate the results through products like the guidance documents and the internet-based and classroom training. On slide 5, you can see some examples of topics that ITRC has addressed in the past. These are the topics that we're offering training classes in 2011. You can see we're offering popular courses from previous years, as well as developing several new courses this year. We also offer classroom training both on vapor intrusion and LNAPLs. More information is available on the ITRC website if you're interested in additional classes, internet-based or classroom. On slide 6, I'll introduce our instructors. All instructors are members of the ITRC Phytotechnology Revision Team. Chris Geller works for the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection's Bureau of Environmental Evaluation and Risk Assessment in Trenton. He provides technical assistance during all phases of site evaluation, from preliminary assessment through site closure. Chris was a team leader of the ITRC Phyto Revision Team. Ellie Wehner is a Corrective Action Program Specialist for the Remediation Division of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality in Austin. Her work currently involves the management and oversight of Corrective Action Program for the division. David Tao is the Deputy Manager and Health, Safety, Security, Environmental Coordinator for the Remediation Engineering and Technology Group in BP's Remediation Management Function. He's located in Warrenville, Illinois. He's responsible for a team of remediation scientists and engineers coordinating, developing, and implementing the technical aspects of all BP cleanup strategies in the Americas. Slide 7, I'll turn today's presentation over to Chris Geller of the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. Chris?
Okay, thanks, Julianne. Can you hear me? Am I unmuted?
You are. Thank you.
Okay, very good. I'm just going to go over a brief overview, talk a little bit about phytotechnologies, and introduce some of the biological aspects of it. And first of all, you're going to learn today that phytotechnologies are a set of technologies, not one technique, but using plants that are able to remediate or contain contaminants. And as a lot of people know, they're attractive green alternatives, they're sustainable, they are low emissions or no emissions that would harm the environment, low energy requirements to maintain and sustain these technologies. They're applicable to all the media that we deal with in the environmental field, and they're widely used throughout the world. Using the ITRC guidance, you're going to see that you can use this regardless of what stage your project is in. The document itself is set up along project life cycles, so you can actually jump in at any point in time. As Julianna mentioned earlier, we replaced two earlier documents and combined them into one. So you can do a systematic evaluation of the various mechanisms and how to apply them on your site, whether you're doing remediation or evaluating a proposal. On slide 8, we've just included this to whet your appetite a little bit. We've got a couple of phytotechnology projects that you can see. The one on the left is a 3-year-old poplar stand that's used for hydraulic control and the remediation of volatile organic compounds in groundwater. And on the right, you have a typical surface soil remediation where the surface soil is stabilized, you're preventing exposure, sequestering TPHs, polyaromatic hydrocarbons, metals, PCBs, all of those compounds, and also remediating VOCs. On slide 9, I've just pointed out some of the benefits that you'll receive by taking this webinar today. You should get a practical understanding of the various phytotechnologies. You'll understand some of the concepts, a lot of the things that we've provided definitions of, and there's a whole host of resources both in the document and then referenced at the end of the document as well. This provides a framework then for consultants, regulators, responsible parties, others who might want to understand the phytotechnology process or process that is going to be proposed or evaluated for use at your site, and then also to track the progress. And hopefully this will save you time and money as you have a compendium of many resources here. And you've also got the ability to add another remediation tool to your personal toolbox. So it's not going to replace all the technologies that you have available to you, but you've got some different resources, some different techniques that you might be able to apply at your sites. On slide 10, I've listed some of the key changes in the current document. We've added FAQ sections. A lot of these came from the EPA website. We've revised and upgraded the decision trees, just made them more useful and applicable to various improvements that we saw as necessary. The decision trees were then incorporated into the document. They were part of a separate document before. And as I said earlier also, and I guess you'll probably hear this a few more times as David goes through the document itself, he's organizing it along a generic life cycle. So anytime your project, you can jump in and get the information that you need. So on slide 11, I've listed the definition of phytotechnologies, and a lot of people consider phytoremediation. We think they're taking a phytoremediation course, but actually within phytoremediation is just one of the technologies under the broad umbrella of phytotechnologies. So the definition is the use of vegetation to contain, sequester, remove, or degrade organic and inorganic contaminants in soil, sediment, surface water, and groundwater. Now, if you had any remediation tool that could do just one or two of those things, you would be excited about it. And with phytotechnologies, you have an opportunity to remediate any type of contamination as applicable in any type of the media that we encounter in the environmental field, and any of the remediation techniques are available as appropriate to your site. Again, a couple of phyto projects on the right-hand side of that slide. You can see how the aesthetics are improved. Planting that tree stand just makes things look nicer, and it's also actually performing remediation at the same time. On slide 12, there are some of the advantages of phytotechnologies. I'm not going to read all of them to you, but I'll look at a few of them. The sustainability, that's a big buzzword these days in the environmental field and in the resource conservation field, and we certainly offer that in phytotechnologies. Solar powered, using minimal of valuable resources to perform the remediation. They're passive and in situ, so they don't require a lot of energy to maintain them. Often there's favorable public perception. People are seeing plants being added to their environment on their block if it's a small site in their neighborhood, things like that. And it can afford educational opportunities. David Sow will be presenting later, has had many opportunities to interact with local scout groups, environmental clubs, and things like that, and get them involved with the implementation of a phytotechnologies project as appropriate, the level of training and the level of contamination that they're involved with. But they might be involved with, the plant selection, perhaps even getting people involved with planting and things like that. Again, as appropriate, if the improper hazmat training, or if hazmat training was needed, then obviously you couldn't bring community groups onto the sites. Slide 13 lists a few more of the advantages. Again, the improvement of the aesthetics. If you had a vacant lot or a brownfield and now you've got a park like bedding, that certainly is one that people are going to be proud to have in the neighborhood and glad to have in the neighborhood. It can also be used as a polishing step. Any contamination may be of a nature that is too great or needs to be reduce the risks quicker than a phyto project might be able to do it, but you can use the phytotechnology then as a polishing step. Again, lower maintenance. They're not non-maintenance, self-repairing. A lot of the willow trees and such will grow back if they're damaged or injured. Creating habitat, that can be a disadvantage as well. You can have an attractive nuisance or bring in some species that needs to be protected and creating a whole new type of condition that you have to deal with. And you can provide restoration, land reclamation during the cleanup and completion of the remediation at your sites. Cost competitiveness, that's always a tough nut to crack accurately, but often the phytotechnologies are cost competitive with some of the more traditional technologies. On slide 14, some of the limitations of the phytotechnologies are listed. The depth is of the contaminants is something that you have to consider. The root influence, which is going to exhibit its presence on areas outside the actual root depth with the breaking up of the soil, the exudation of certain chemicals and so on, will go beyond the actual root depth, so you can actually get influence beyond that depth. The area, sometimes you, depending on the technology and what you're trying to accomplish, you would require a larger tract of land than is available, so that would be a limiting factor. Timeliness, certain state programs and federal programs require remediation to be completed within a certain time frame, and the phytotechnologies might take longer than those time frames allow. And they're susceptible to seasonal and diurnal variations, which may present an unfavorable condition when the plants are not doing their thing in the winter, say, that perhaps you're using them to lower groundwater or using them as phyto pumps. They're not pumping them, so you have to consider alternatives that you'll get a year-long, year-round remediation. On slide 15, some of the regulatory issues, again, the timeliness issue. A lot of people need to know what you're going to do if you're going to be harvesting plants that are taking up contaminants. How are you going to harvest them and dispose of them? If you have ecological concerns with the contaminants moving into the plant tissues, are those going to be ingested by other organisms? Perhaps the contaminant levels are too high to even do any planting. Plants won't tolerate those contaminant levels in soil or groundwater, whatever you're trying to treat. The transfer of contaminants to the media, you may be taking up contamination from groundwater and discharging it through the plant into the air. Is that going to be an acceptable method of moving that around? Sometimes the byproducts may be more toxic as chemicals are broken down. And you have to consider your health and safety to your workers and others who might be exposed to the plants and contaminants during each phase of a phytotechnology. On slide 16, now we're going to introduce just a few little basic rudiments of plant physiology. As you probably know, most plants grow by sending their roots into the soil, and then they produce leafy and woody materials above the ground. And to do this, the plants use carbon dioxide, they use light energy, which is converted into chemical energy, and that produces the carbon biomass through the process of photosynthesis. So that's what's going on in the leaves, and also cellular respiration. So the plants have to take up liquid water and dissolve inorganic nutrients through the root system and transport them throughout the plant and in the xylem, which is the tissue that moves the materials up from the root zone and into the plant, and then transpire the water through the leaves as water vapor. So oxygen is released into the environment, and carbon dioxide and water are being exchanged. So the chemicals produced during the photosynthetic process are transported through the plant and through the phloem, which goes down into the root zone, and they may be exuded into the surrounding soil, which then enhances the plant's ability to translocate the materials or the vital nutrients in the soil into the plant, and just creates this process. And that's sort of the fundamentals of how the phytotechnology process works. And then on slide 17, there's a table. This is from the ITRC document, as is the previous picture. And it lists a number of the essential nutrients and the macronutrients, micronutrients, and so on that are included in a plant or needed for plant metabolism. And what these are listed here just to show what you might find in a typical plant. And then a lot of these macro and micronutrients are brought into the plant through the root zone, and the interaction with the plant trying to obtain these nutrients might also be used as the plant tries to or substitutes some of these nutrients with some of the inorganic that are in the soil and taking them up into the plant, the same mechanism that is used to take the essential nutrients in. So I hope I didn't angle that too much, but Ellie's going to clear this all up, so I'll turn it over to her.
Okay, hi. Can you all hear me okay?
Yeah.
Well, once produced, this is just a figure kind of showing a blow-up of what's going on at the root level. And once produced, you have those phytochemicals, which are identified in the slide as nutrients or exudates, that big E, black E, kind of throughout the blow-up of that figure, are transported down into the roots via that phloem, where they can be exuded as a carbon source into the root zone. And as a result, you've got these soil organisms, which would include bacteria and fungi, which are going to tend to really thrive just in the immediate vicinity surrounding those roots. And in addition to that, the root system will typically reside in an oxygenated environment, either by creating the channels where that atmospheric oxygen can diffuse, or by exuding oxygen through the root tissues. And this collective region of soil roots and organisms is known as the rhizosphere, and it extends approximately 1 to 3 millimeters from the root surface, and that's the kind of depicted in this slide as that gray shaded area. So let's go on to slide 19, and this is another physiological process which is really unique to plants, and that's evapotranspiration, and it's just the ability of plants to physically interact with and affect water movement. So what's being illustrated in the sequence of events in this slide, which you see identified as step A, B, and C, is rain interception capacity. And this sequence is also shown in Figure 1-3 of the technical and regulatory document. In sequence A, what's going on is you just have rain beginning to fall, and what happens is the plant canopy, or that umbrella effect of the plants, is basically capturing some of that water on the leaf surface. And some of that water will never hit the ground, just the water is essentially retained on the plant surface. So at the start of the rain event, you have a lot of water that's going to be captured on the leaf surface, and some of that rain will also miss the plant entirely and just hit the ground adjacent to the plant. And during the rain event in step B, at some point, if that rain event is large enough or has a long duration or intensity, that plant interception capacity is going to be exceeded. And some of that water eventually begins to fall on the ground and starts to infiltrate into the soil. And at this point, it can either form surface water runoff or it's going to infiltrate into the shallow root zone. In sequence C, at the end of the rain event, the sun comes out, you've got evaporation beginning to occur, and the water that was trapped on the plant surface and was kind of always sitting there will simply evaporate, and in addition to that, you've got the plant that's also going to be transpiring, and that it's pulling that shallow water up from the root zone and transpiring it out into the atmosphere. So those are a couple of unique physiological kind of things that are really unique to plants in particular that we'll kind of be discussing how it really supports these phytotechnology mechanisms. And in slide 20 is kind of a basic summary of the phytotechnology mechanisms, and this is table 1-3 out of the guidance document. Just provides that summary of the 6 most common mechanisms, which are listed in that left column. And I'm going to be providing a brief description of each of these mechanisms over the next several slides. And as they're listed as phytosequestration, rhizodegradation, phytohydraulics, phytoextraction, phytodegradation, and finally phytovolatilization. And the way, also want to point out that we kind of listed these 6 mechanisms sequentially in order to correlate to the actual kind of the different levels of a plant. For example, 1, phytosequestration being the most common mechanism occurring at the root zone, whereas 6, you've got phytovolatilization, and that's going to be the most common mechanism occurring at the top or the leaf canopy of a plant. So basically, this table is just used to show you what cleanup goals would equate to a particular phytotechnology mechanism. So, for example, if you had a cleanup goal of containment of a contaminant, that's all you wanted to do, there are going to be specific mechanisms that you'd want to use. For example, phytosequestration and phytohydraulics. In many cases, though, and what I've mostly encountered is that folks really want to do remediation, where you're actually using these plants to physically clean up a site. And as you can see in the table, you've got rhizodegradation, phytoextraction, phytodegradation, phytovolatilization. These are all mechanisms that you could potentially harness when using plants as the actual cleanup mechanism. Also, just keep in mind that one phytotechnology application can potentially harness several different mechanisms, particularly if your cleanup goal is going to involve both containment and remediation of a site. So let's talk about phytosequestration, moving on to slide 21. And this figure is really meant to kind of show that phytosequestration, the rhizodegradation that's going on with that blow-up image on the upper right or upper left. And this slide is the same as figure 1-5 out of the guidance document. In step A, you've got phytochemical complexation going on, and what's happening is that some of those nutrients or exudates are interacting with the contaminants, which are identified as the little red C in the upper diagram of that slide. And the nutrients and exudates are actually complexing with that contaminant, causing it to no longer be mobile in the soil environment. Essentially, it just precipitates out. A couple other sub-mechanisms to mention are identified in the bottom half of the slide. We've got B, we've got transport protein inhibition, and C at the bottom is vascular storage. And in the transport protein inhibition submechanism, it's kind of shown in the lower right diagram, that yellow B and the green circle. You've got these transport proteins which are located within plant roots, and they actually function to irreversibly bind the contaminants and prevent them from entering into the plant. The other submechanism is called vacuolar storage, and that's shown in the lower right diagram. You've got the yellow C in the green circle. And in this submechanism, if a contaminant actually gets into a plant, it can be permanently stored within its cells in a structure called the vacuole. But basically, all of these mechanisms are functioning to reduce the mobility of a contaminant and prevent migration of it into the surrounding media. So moving on to slide 22, this is illustrating rhizodegradation. And again, what's happening is in this slide is that you've got a lot of bioactivity occurring in the root zone surrounding the plant. And the plant itself is actually providing some of that machinery to support or aid the remediation or degradation process. And as I mentioned earlier, that rhizosphere includes the collective region of the soil, roots, and organisms that extends out approximately 1 to 3 millimeters from that root surface. And basically, this mechanism is using those exuded phytochemicals from a plant and water, which is physically being drawn in by the plant, to enhance the microbial biodegradation of contaminants in the rhizosphere. And this region is often also going to be the first area of contact between a soil or a groundwater contaminant with the plant. Details of the specific chemical processes, which are shown on the bottom of the slide, are kind of covered in detail in section 1.2.2. Basically, what is occurring with rhizodegradation is bioremediation that's just being stimulated by the plant. Slide 23 is phytohydraulics, and this slide is really just a placeholder just illustrating the process of evapotranspiration. And in many phytotechnology applications, what you want to do is actually access sources of surface water or groundwater directly. And in this slide, we want to assume the movement of groundwater in the subsurface flowing from the right to the left of that slide. So what you want to do is plant your trees or a stand of trees to specifically intercept that groundwater flow. And once those tree roots are sufficiently developed, there's going to be the formation of what's called a cone of depression because of the combined root systems and their ability to draw water out of that specific groundwater zone. So it's almost, this is something, again, that's going to fluctuate daily because your plant is going to be turning on and off as the sun comes up and goes down each day. So it's almost acting like a cyclical pump. One classification of trees that has been widely studied in phytotechnologies are the phreatophytes, which are these deep-rooted, high-transpiring, water-loving trees that can survive in conditions of temporary saturation. And some examples of phreatophytes will often include species of the Salicaceae family, which would include the cottonwoods, poplars, and willow trees, which really tend to harness this phytohydraulic mechanism. I'll throw in one successful case that we had in Texas where this mechanism was applied was with a facility that was proposing the closure of a stormwater retention basin. And what they did was plant a temporary stand of poplars inside that basin in order to support dewatering efforts for that unit. And overall, actually the project ended up being quite successful. And so they didn't have to mechanically pump out all that stormwater. So moving on to slide 24 is phytoextraction. And with phytoextraction, what you're doing is physically extracting the contaminant using the plant as the mechanism to make those contaminants more accessible. And once a contaminant is taken up, that plant's either going to store that chemical and or its byproducts into the plant biomass, the tissues, or actually sequester it into the cell's vacuoles, similar to the vacuolar storage that I mentioned earlier. Now, inorganics will tend to be the most common contaminant that can be phytoextracted, but you can also get organic contaminants that can be subjected successfully to this mechanism. The primary difference between an organic versus an inorganic contaminant in phytoextraction is that an organic contaminant will tend to be degraded or broken down much further by what's going on inside the plant. various factors that are going to affect the potential uptake into plants are discussed in greater detail in section 1.2.4 of the document. But as a general rule of thumb, some readily bioavailable inorganics for plant uptake would include arsenic, cadmium, copper, nickel, selenium, and zinc, whereas chromium, lead, and uranium will tend not to be very bioavailable. Those are pretty tough to address with phytoextraction. For organic contaminants, one important factor that's been shown to correlate to contaminant uptake into a plant is its octanol water partition coefficient, or log KOW. And there's a lot of research out there that has shown that organic contaminants with these log KOW values that fall range between 1 and 3.5, such as benzene, toluene, and TCE, are able to be easily absorbed into plant roots and translocated into the shoot tissues of the plant. So moving on to slide 25. Another mechanism, and this is phytodegradation, occurs when you've got contaminants which are broken down by the plant itself just through various internal enzymatic reactions and metabolic processes which are occurring inside that plant. Plants produce enzymes, and some of those enzymes can actually function to degrade those contaminants. And on this slide, A is used to show you the level where this enzymatic activity would most likely be occurring in that plant. And photosynthesis is also going to be generating a highly oxidative reductive cycle within a plant. And it's this oxidation reduction cycling that's going to offer an additional contaminant breakdown potential, and that's called photosynthetic oxidation. And that's kind of, on this slide, B is used to show you the level where this photosynthetic oxidation would most likely be occurring. Obviously, it's going to be at the leaf or canopy level where you've got photosynthesis occurring. On slide 26 is a summary of phytovolatilization. And this is the last mechanism that was listed on table 1-3, and this occurs when contaminants are essentially volatilized out of a plant via the leaf, stomata, or plant stems. And once they're volatilized, those chemicals are going to react very rapidly in the atmosphere with hydroxyl radicals, which are an oxidant that's formed during the photochemical cycle. And some organics, such as TCE, even some inorganic contaminants, such as mercury, are known to actually volatilize out of the plant. And obviously, the chemical characteristics of a particular contaminant, such as its Henry's law constant and vapor pressure, are really going to dictate the ability of contaminants to phytovolatilize. Well, on slide 27, just applying those phytotechnologies successfully to any site is going to involve a lot of things. Selecting, designing, installing, operating, maintaining, and monitoring these planted systems that are going to potentially utilize any number of these phytotechnology mechanisms that I've described earlier. So the tables that are presented in this slide and the next slide are taken out of the ITRC guidance document. These are references table 15A and 15B. So there's going to be more description in the document about all of these tables, but these tables are really put in there to provide you with a quick pick list of specific phytotechnology applications depending on the type of media you've got, either clean or impacted, and depending on your specific treatment goal, either it's going to be either containment or remediation or a mixture of both. So what we're looking at in Table 15A are containment applications. So if your strategy is to do containment of contaminants at your site and your media is soil, sediment, surface water, groundwater, this table is going to provide some phytotechnology applications that you might want to look at. And not just the application was presented, but what we kind of added what kind of mechanisms would be relevant specifically for that particular application. And just an initial note about this table, applications that are bolded in the table are actually covered in detail as specific case studies. So some other potential applications associated with this containment slide are riparian buffers, ponds, lagoons, and basins. And we included these water features in this table simply because you could have submerged vegetation in your pond or lagoon that could also be contributing to some of the stabilization or remediation work. And we also threw in there tree hydraulic barriers again, the ability of trees in this case to control hydraulics just by simply taking up either clean water, or if it's impacted, you can still use it as a method to control groundwater movement. But you're also going to be doing remediation as well. So slide 28 is the next component of that, and this is table 15B, and this is showing you some of the possible applications for addressing impacted media when you're actually looking at remediation as your treatment goal, and impacted media being soil, sediment, surface water, or groundwater. And again, table 15A and B are just meant to give you that quick pick of media and showing you what kind of applications might be relevant to it and identifying the types of mechanisms that you might have at your disposal. And it's important to remember when using these tables that not all of the mechanisms are going to be applicable to your site. In fact, you can select some of these mechanisms just based on different plant species, or in some cases, some of the chemicals will simply not be able to be degraded within a plant or within different zones of a plant system. So what are some of the most common phytotechnology applications out there? And we kind of initially listed some of the ones that we've seen and I've personally seen at some of the projects I've worked on in Texas. This is slide 29. And this is covered specifically these general applications. In particular, the case summary reference table is table 1-6 in the guidance document. And these will, again, the first one on that is phytostabilization covers. This is where we're using plants to provide just a natural barrier and resistance to erosion and leaching. And obviously plants with the most fibrous root systems, such as the grasses, are really going to make the best phytostabilization cover systems, where you've got your typical focus of effectiveness at about 1 to 2 feet below the ground surface, and that's obviously the most likely depth where the concentration of your roots is going to be the highest. And another way to stabilize contaminants in the subsurface is for infiltration control. And landfill covers specifically used for infiltration control are commonly referred to as evapotranspiration covers, or ET covers. Next on that list is phytoremediation ground covers. And these are just cover systems using densely rooted ground covers, ground cover plants or grasses to actually phytoremediate contaminants. Next one would be tree hydraulic barriers, and this application is where we're using tree stands or groups of trees to extract groundwater contamination, or just groundwater essentially to create a hydraulic containment barrier where the trees are being used to kind of influence the flow of groundwater. Most common tree hydraulic barrier applications will tend to concentrate the plantings of these trees either up gradient of a contaminant plume or right at the downgrading edge of a plume, a contaminant plume, in order to kind of influence the groundwater flow. And all of these, the tree hydraulic barrier applications, are simply applying a phytohydraulic mechanism. Phytoremediation tree stands, pretty obvious, this is where we're using tree stands to specifically phytoremediate deeper soils and contaminated groundwater plumes located near the top of the water table. And although tree stands and hydraulic barriers are generally focused on the use and application of trees, you can have other species such as very deep-rooted prairie grasses that may be an option at your site. Some grass species are known to have very dense root systems that extend to about 10 to 15 feet below ground surface. And I can say in many regions in Texas, grasses will tend to be the predominant species of vegetation and will often perform better in some of those phytotechnology applications. Finally, we've got riparian buffers at the bottom of this slide. These are where you're placing plants along surface water bodies just to provide that bank stabilization, and or they can also be used to remediate surface water and near surface groundwater. So the next module, which will be given by David, is going to cover some of the basic requirements needed in order to develop a successful phytotechnology project. So at this point, I'm going to stop, turn it over to Juliana to take some questions.
Thank you, Ellie. We have a simulcast question from Alan Liu at Weston Solutions in Concord, New Hampshire. This refers to slide 27, so you're welcome to use the list of slide numbers along the left to jump back. Slide 27, is phyto a viable technology to treat heavy metals which are not so bioavailable? any proven measures to increase the bioavailability? What are the major aspects of the technology to be concerned for those that are not so bioavailable metals?
This is David. I'll try to answer some of that. Yes, there have been applications of phyto for different heavy metals or other inorganic contaminants that are not so bioavailable. A couple ways. One is the phytosequestration mechanism. Basically, you're changing the soil chemistry by through the plant, using the plant to change the soil chemistry so that the inorganic contaminant or heavy metal is less bioavailable. So you're actually reducing its mobility, looking at, you know, mobility, volume, toxicity, those types of criteria for risk. You're actually reducing its mobility by sequestering it into the soil matrix itself. The other option is phytoextraction, which is the use of the plants to pull out the metal. A couple ways of doing that are there are certain hyperaccumulator plants that are out there. Basically, they extract high concentrations of certain metals. And I'll talk about a database in my part of the talk that has some of that information, but there is a way to use some specific species of plants to extract metals. The other option that has been tried with some success, but there's a big caution associated with it, is using some sort of a soil treatment like citric acid or a chelating agent or some kind of a chemical to apply onto metal-impacted soils, which then make the extraction part through the plant much more readily available. The danger, of course, is if you apply something that makes it more mobile to get into the plant, it's also more mobile to potentially leach down the groundwater. So there is a big, you know, a caution associated with that particular approach, but it has been tried in the field.
Thank you. I'll also refer the person with the question. ITRC has a training class on applying monitored natural attenuation processes to metals and rads in groundwater. So you may also be interested in looking at that ITRC tool. And more information is on the ITRC website. A question from Eric White at PARS Environmental in New Jersey. How does the photosynthesis respiration cycle affect the soil redox and treatment of chlorinated compounds such as PCE? Do the roots emit O2 at night and CO2 during the day?
All cells respire, meaning they do have a gas exchange occurring. They need oxygen to actually function. Some plants do exude oxygen into the root zone through the root system itself, primarily to deal with saturated soil conditions more than anything, but also again need to have the oxygen to respire as well. In terms of the use of photosynthesis and respiration to deal with chlorinateds, there are different mechanisms, I guess is the best way to put it. You know, there's a whole soil chemistry that's going on that the plant root interacts with. Again, things like exchange of gases, changing of redox conditions, exporting of carbon into the subsurface, particularly during seasonal senescence. In other words, when the plants go dormant, there's a large export of carbon that can lead to very reductive conditions that can then stimulate reductive dechlorination of chlorinated compounds. The other option is chlorinated compounds can get extracted into the plant, and once inside the plant, there is intracellular enzymes called the halogenases, which actually are used to provide chlorine nutrition, chlorine being one of those essential nutrients that Chris presented in one of the first tables, actually, in the slides. Chlorine is an essential nutrient, and the halogenase enzyme that is produced in a plant is actually used in that nutritional cycle for harvesting chlorine. Well, the halogenase can also harvest the chlorine from a chlorinated compound. So there are different mechanisms associated with how the plant can deal with chlorinated compounds. The photosynthesis part of it is really just the production of that dehalogenase. I mean, all carbon-based materials within a plant, including the enzymes, are that carbon was originated during the photosynthetic cycle.
And we'll take one last question during this question and answer break. This one refers to slide 15. It's from Vivek Lal at Battelle in Columbus, Ohio. Referring to slide 15, what technologies are used to dispose contaminated plant waste after harvesting?
I'm on the wrong slide. Okay. Disposal of the plant material after harvesting?
Yes.
Okay. Depending on the contaminant, and I actually will talk about an incident where this actually can pose a risk, but depending on the contaminant, you can either incinerate it or some form of, you know, drying the material. The big advantage of that is basically you're reducing the wet volume down to a dry volume, and the total amount of material you're disposing, say, into a landfill, whether it's hazardous or, you know, otherwise classified, depends on the concentration. The big advantage is the reduction in the total mass that you're sending off site. That's typically something you're going to do for an inorganic contaminant that's been phytoextracted into the plant because, of course, once inside the plant, there's, you know, most metals won't have any further transformation occurring. On the organic side, contaminant side, my typical advice is that you don't need to harvest at all because the plant, the rhizosphere, and all the mechanisms that Ellie talked about are sufficient to break down that contaminant. And in most cases, whenever you sample tissue and look for the contaminant, you're going to either find it as a very transient concentration. In other words, it's just simply, you know, flowing with the transpirational fluid. Or you can't find it at all, because there are a lot of breakdown mechanisms in the rhizosphere first, in the plant environment itself second. And in most cases, one of the last mechanisms that Ellen mentioned, the phytovolatilization, you cannot find most organics volatilizing in that stream. It's just not, you know, everything else is broken down before you get there.
Thank you. We will wrap up this question and answer break and move on to slide 31 for the next section of our training class. And I'm going to turn it over to David Tao from BP Corporation to continue. Thank you.
Thanks, Juliana. Okay, on slide 31, as Chris had mentioned early on in his portion of the talk, we wrote this document kind of to be independent of the regulatory program that you're in. So we wrote it as a generic project life cycle, and those five steps that you see on slide 31, from site assessment all the way to closure, are kind of the general five steps that you would go through regardless of what program you're in. And we wrote the document based on those five stages just, again, as Chris mentioned, so that you can jump into the relevant portion that you need to based on where you are in your project. Two other things to mention about the actual picture on slide 31 is the two stages up on the left side, site assessment and remedy selection, you actually haven't selected phytotechnologies at either of these stages yet. But there are pieces of information that you need to know in, say, your site assessment activity that are then relevant for whether or not phytotechnology might be appropriate for your site. So here we're not telling you how to do a site assessment at all. There's all kinds of documents out there to do that. But we are telling you what do you need to look at in your site assessment that could then help you select or determine whether phyto is even applicable at your site. And similarly for remedy selection, again, we're not presupposing that phytotechnology is going to be selected for your site. It tells you what are the things you need to know in order to make that decision to select phyto as a remedy, or at least have it as one of the options in your feasibility study, and then compared to your other options that are out there for addressing the same environmental situation that you have. The three boxes on the right from design, implementation, operation, maintenance, monitoring, and closure, those three steps of the process, you have actually selected phytotechnology as a remedy. And here, and the information that's contained in the document is really that detailed how-to information the things that you need to do know in order to actually design and implement design an installation. You know, how do you actually implement it? What kind of equipment do you use? How fast can you do it? You know, those types of really detailed how-to information is contained in the last three steps. Also, again, you know, this is a long-term, typically a long-term technology, so operation, maintenance, and monitoring are very important for FIDO technologies, and we spend a lot of time on the different things that you need to do in order to operate and maintain it, and ultimately monitor the performance of it over time. And then finally, of course, the closure piece of it. And one of the things we also do talk about in particularly these last three stages is how it all connects back into that front-end part of it. So when you're evaluating the technology in the first place, you kind of need to know the things about how do you design it, how do you implement it, how do you operate and maintain it, and so on, and how you eventually close your site when you're actually selecting the technology in the first place. So a lot of this detailed how-to information that's contained in the last three chapters of the document are actually needed for your remedy selection and even in your site assessment portion. This five-box diagram is actually used on every slide throughout the remainder of this talk to kind of illustrate where we are in the process. So, some parts of the discussion will actually cover more than one of these parts of the project lifecycle. So each slide hereafter actually contains these five boxes and highlights which section we're in. So moving on to slide 32, this is the first section in site assessment, which is section 2.2 in the document. Here we talk about the different types of information that are needed for site assessment, and we break this up into two parts, the general information. So this is information you're going to collect in any site assessment, things like the site description history, contaminant assessment, where is it located, what kind of concentrations, what is the contaminant from a chemical standpoint, as well as your hydrogeology, your exposure risk pathways, and those types of things. But what we do in the actual section of this document in the site assessment is how does this information then translate into understanding where or when FIDO technologies could actually be applied. And then the other part of this section is actually the FIDO-specific information. This is information that really isn't considered general site assessment information that you collect. And in a way, what we're recommending is that you begin to start collecting this as your standard practice. But these would be things like the soil health and agronomics. You know, how healthy is that, or how fertile is the soil at your site? Something you're not going to need to know for, say, a pump and treat system, but certainly is relevant for FIDO. And if you're going to compare, a FIDO hydraulic barrier to a pump and treat system, this is a piece of information you also need to have in order to make that comparison. Same thing with climate conditions. Again, you know, most mechanical systems are going to be very independent of the climate conditions that they're in. Certainly for a FIDO site, it's very relevant because it dictates the plant growth and the overall health. And then the last thing that we do recommend on the FIDO-specific basis is what is the existing vegetation at the site. And I'll get into quite a bit of that in a few slides. In addition to the general site assessment information, on slide 33, part of that also tells you what is your project objective. Again, when you do a site assessment, you figure out what's your impacted media, what's your contaminant, and ultimately what's your exposure and risk associated with that environmental situation. And then from that, with the output of the site assessment is basically what are your objectives? Do you want to, is containment a strategy that you want to approach at this site? Remediation certainly would be more beneficial. And if you could do both, containment and remediation, that would be the end-all be-all. And again, Ellie kind of mentioned some of these different applications of FIDO, whether it's a ground cover or a tree barrier or some sort of a tree stand type of system. What kind of project objectives or strategies could you get out of each of those? So in terms of containment only, FIDO stabilization covers are really just holding the soil or holding the material, the contaminant, in place. It's not really removing it or degrading it or doing anything else, but it's addressing the mobility part of the risk. So it's reducing that mobility overall. Similarly, hydraulic barriers, which is really just dealing with groundwater. It's just pumping groundwater, controlling the groundwater movement. In turn, you're controlling the movement of contaminants that may be present in a portion of that groundwater. Remediation, certainly, again, would be a better project objective. That's actually, you know, not just reducing mobility, because typically you're going to get that, you know, in any of these systems, but there's some sort of a breakdown or degradation or removal mechanism occurring as well that's actually, you know, reducing toxic, you know, reducing the volume of contaminants that are present at your site. Whether, again, it could be degradation, it could be removal, it could be, you know, whatever that mechanism is. And then certainly, really, when you look at phyto overall, you know, combining a phyto stabilization cover with a phyto remediation ground cover is really just a cover system, if you will. So it's a combined cover at that point, and you can get both containment and remediation out of it. And similarly for, you know, a tree stands or tree barriers, you're going to get remediation in the root zone regardless if the contaminant, you know, if you target your planting for the contaminated zone, you're going to get both hydraulic control as well as remediation. Moving on to slide 34, and also a bit on to slide 35, you know, again, we take the general site assessment information, things like site description and history, and then there's also the contaminant assessment, the hydrogeology, and the risk assessment part of it. And what we do in the document, again, is identify what is the specific piece of information that is collected, how do you use it in assessing phyto, and ultimate, or different parts of phyto, really, in terms of implementation or, you know, operation and maintenance of it. And what we're showing on slide 34 is basically the example content of a series of tables. Table 2-3 is taking the general site assessment information. The left-hand column is basically the discipline or competency that might be required in order for the assessment to be done. The information that's in the black, so like surface features, historic use of pesticides, is actually the information you're collecting. So this is, you know, this comes with the typical site description or history of your facility to, you know, in your general site assessment activity. And what you would use that for in terms of phyto is shown in blue. So surface features and obstructions might be helpful to figure out what kind of implementation equipment you might need in the future in order to install a phyto system. So certainly if you've got a lot of concrete or cobble or other types of hard material, that's going to change what kind of equipment you might use to actually plant your site in the future. So that's kind of the design of these tables, table 2-3 in particular, for the general site assessment. What's shown in the slide 34 is actually the cutout for the site description and history piece of that. Again, on slide 35, the continuation of that is basically, you know, very similarly for the contaminant assessment. So this would be like the concentration, composition, where it's located, what kind of media is impacting, being impacted, and so on. And then again in blue, you know, how does that translate into using it for a phytotechnology itself? Bait and transport, for example. Does that contaminant get into the plant tissue? Well, you need to know the composition of that contaminant, how concentrated is it, and whether it's in the root zone, you know, whether it's in the depth that your plant can actually reach down to. Again, bait and transport-based questions can be answered from that. And similarly for hydrogeological conditions and exposure assessment. Moving on to slide 36, a counterpart to that table that I just talked about is table 2-4, which is for the phyto-specific assessment information. And again, that's the things like the soil health or the soil agronomic conditions, and that's things like soil structure, compaction, fertility, the nutrient content, and so on. And of course, that translates again into some phyto-specific pieces like nutrition, irrigation, and fertilization needs. So things that you might need to know in your long-term operation and maintenance. A lot of these also will come into play when you're looking at plant selection and screening. In other words, what species could you use at your site that could actually do the remediation? May have some dependency on how healthy the soil is. May have and will have, absolutely will have, dependency on what climate conditions you have at your site. And then the best place to start really is the existing vegetation. In a way, Mother Nature is already telling you what can grow at the site by just simply going out there and identifying the species. And one thing I would recommend in that identification process is not just the scientific name, you know, like Salix alba, which is white poplar or white willow. You also get white willow, the common name, because believe it or not, common names are different depending on what region of the state U.S. you are or even different countries that you may be in. The scientific name is the standard that is constant throughout each of those. So I would recommend not just getting the common name, but definitely get the scientific name of that species that you're, you know, is already growing at your site. And again, that, you know, plant selection and, you know, selecting the plant species for your final implementation are kind of, again, the things that, you know, Mother Nature is telling you for your application. Taking that to a little more detail on slide 37, the first part of remedy selection. So here we're, you know, we've moved from the site assessment phase into actually selecting a remedy that, a phytoremedy that might be applicable at your site. The first thing you need to do, though, however, is figure out, do you actually have any plants that will meet all the needs that you have at the site? So what we start with and what we recommend in the document is to start with the survey that you just did during your site assessment of the existing species at your site. And then try to answer some of the questions that are kind of shown in Figure 2.1, which is a very basic decision diagram, if you will, looking at things like suitability and appropriateness for the remediation that you want to do at the site. What we do is basically after you have a list of species that are, you know, present at your site, you want to be able to go into some database, a phyto database, if you will, and see if has it been used, has this plant species been used for the contaminant I have present at my site? And is it suitable? In other words, is it growing, does it have the same climate conditions, does it have the same soil? And those types of factors that you do want to consider, if both of those match up, great, then that's a, you know, again, Mother Nature's already telling you can grow at the site. The database or the body of literature that's out there, the research that's out there, shows that it can be used for your contaminant. That's you're already a step up on everything because you've already got something that, one, actually may be doing some remediation out there already. You just need to promote that further and, you know, either promote the growth of that species beyond where it's already growing and move forward with that. If you don't have any of that, you know, plant species that are growing at your site that actually are, you know, meet all that criteria, are in the database and so on, maybe there's a database species that is also suitable for your site. So this is step number two in the decision tree on slide 37. You know, it may be a species that's in the database that says it can address your contaminant but isn't growing at your site, but it actually could be grown at your site. So you need to find a commercial source of that, go out and promote and plant that particular species at your site. So again, you're kind of a step up there because you already have a body of literature, you know, publications that say, yeah, it works for this type of contaminant. It's suitable for our site. It's just not growing there for some, you know, because it's just not, has not been, been able to establish itself at that site. You need to go and perhaps help that out. Another step after that, is, this is the third one, is basically taking the hybrid or related species. So if you remember your basic biology, family, genus, species, if you've got a species, you know, at that level that is identified or, you know, available, that would be great. But if not, then you move up into the genus level. Maybe there's a related, you know, within the same genus species that you could use that could, you know, meets, you know, it's in the database and suitable, meets those criteria as well, and then you can consider that species for your site. The next step, which is number four, and I'll talk a little more detail of this later, is maybe there's something growing at your site but isn't in the database. Maybe you actually have a chance here to build on the, you know, the body of literature that's out there and say, is the species actually doing anything to actually address the contamination at my site? There's nothing in the literature that says it does, but obviously it's growing at the site already. Maybe it's mapping out where contamination is or isn't. You know, if it's just simply growing in the clean zones, then that gives you an indication on your site assessment side that maybe that's where the contamination isn't located, or vice versa. You know, maybe it's actually mapping out where the contamination is located. And again, you would do some additional studies, and I'll talk about these additional studies in a bit. We call them, in general, screening studies. You're basically screening different plant species for whether it's growing in contaminated media, whether it's not. Does it actually do any, you know, remediation itself? Is it helping to biodegrade an organic contaminant, or is it extracting any of the metals that are present at the site, or whatever it is? But you would need to do a little more further study based on that, based on, you know, again, these are species growing at your site that aren't currently in any database. And then finally, the last one is the genetically modified organism, or GMO species. you know, this is basically, you know, a lot of this comes from academia where, you know, there's genetic modification going on of, you know, different plant species. Certainly in agriculture, in terms of corn production or potatoes or, you know, wheat or whatever, there's genetically modified organisms being developed now for different growth or, you know, promoting different resistances or whatever. There are also, you know, academicians looking at genetically modifying plant species to do better remediation. Whether or not that's a good thing or bad thing, you know, from a perception standpoint to apply in a field site, you know, there's all kinds of public either misunderstanding or just, you know, unknowns about whether or not GMO species are a good thing or a bad thing to apply at a site. The research is out there, certainly. Whether or not you apply it, you know, basically becomes a regulatory discussion, a community acceptance issue, those types of factors beyond just the technical that need to be discussed. I should say that there are a couple field sites out there that I'm aware of where genetically modified species have been planted specifically for remediating the contaminant that's present at those sites. So it is out there. But again, there's a lot of discussion that goes on, you know, that needs to go on behind the scenes, if you will, instead of just the technical reasons to do it. But overall, if you get through this figure 2.1 in the document, which is this very quick, you know, plant screening process, and you get to, you know, all the way down to the genetically modified species, level 5, and you really don't have any other species to look at, and that's really not acceptable, then that's it. You're done. Phyto is not your option for this site. Simply because you don't have any plant species to, you know, that are viable to be able to use at the site. If you end up with, you know, hopefully a handful, you know, a dozen or half dozen of species that you can consider this technology for, then that's when you move on into the next step that we'll talk about in a few minutes. One of the things that we're very conscientious of in the document as well as in this training is to make sure that we don't oversell the technology. One of the biggest problems that Phyto experienced a decade ago was that everybody saw it as the silver bullet and we're, you know, misapplying it to the wrong conditions. Either, you know, selecting species that weren't really applicable to their site because of the climate conditions or just really weren't, you know, applicable to the contaminants that were present. Either way, it, you know, it did more damage to the technology than anything. So we're very conscientious in this course to say when and when this technology is not applicable. And in every decision tree that we have in the document, there's always that out, that consider another option out, if you will. And in this particular decision tree, figure 2.1, we give you that. If you can't find any species, then you're done. You have no more options left, if you will, for considering phyto. Moving on to slide 38, I talked a couple times in that last slide about plant databases, and slide 38 kind of captures some of those that are out there. And in reference to one of the questions at the break about the different metals, the Environment Canada PhytoREM database is a good place to start to look at different metals. So in that sub-bullet, you can see all the different elements that are in the database itself. It cross-references all the different species that are known to either tolerate it. In other words, it just simply is able to grow in soil that's impacted with this but isn't really doing anything. It's just able to survive it. There are other plant species that are known as precipitators. These are, you know, basically the phytosequestration mechanism that Ellie talked about, where, you know, the plant is interacting with the soil chemistry, causing that metal to then precipitate out and basically remove its mobility. And then there's also the hyper or, you know, the accumulators, which are just basically able to extract metals. Chris touched on this a little bit, Ellie touched on it even more, where, you know, phytoextraction, the mechanism associated with that, there are inorganic nutrients that are, you know, required for growth and metabolism, like copper. That's a good example. That's one of them in the bullets on slide 38. It's an essential nutrient, so all plants have to take up copper. So there's accumulators of copper out there. Some do it more, some do it less. Hyperaccumulators is a special class of, you know, classification of accumulator plants. You know, again, hyperaccumulators can actually accumulate more, you know, typically 3 or 4 orders of magnitude higher than what a normal plant can do. So if you really want to extract a metal, one place you go is this database to say, here's a plant species that's a known hyperaccumulator of this metal, and then go in and plant that at the site, assuming it's suitable, assuming it, you know, it grows in that climate and so on. Similarly, there's a crude oil database that was developed by the University of Saskatchewan, by Jim Jeremiah up in Canada. And basically that's broken out by the ecotype. So it looks at prairie species, mesic species, wetland species, and kind of looks at where, you know, what kind of crude oil, you know, where crude oil releases have occurred, where the ecosystem has restored itself, and basically indicating that the plant species had some environmental benefit to them. Not just, and this one thing I should also mention, that database also includes salinity or brine release impacts as well. So it's more than just, you know, in crude oil you bring up not just the crude oil, but you also bring up a lot of brine or salty water with that, and that is also incorporated in this database as well. In terms of refined products, one of the things that I did initially when I started at, you know, looking into this technology was to figure out which plant species did well for gasoline in particular, oxygenated gasoline specifically, MTBE, methyl tertiary butyl ether, or ethanol-containing gasoline as well. And basically we screened all kinds of landscape species as well as water detention basin species. The reason is, When we first started getting into the technology of Phyto, it just so happened that we being BP, were going through a rebranding effort for all of our service stations. And one of the questions that came up was, you know, one of the things we do at the very end of our raise and rebuild of our retail sites is re-landscaping. Is there some other plant species we should be considering in order to deal with gasoline if there's ever a release of gasoline at that service station? So we went through and screened hundreds of different landscape species, not, you know, things like, you know, different trees, shrubs, grasses, and also the detention basin species. So a lot of, you know, I live up in the Midwest where we have water retention basins everywhere for stormwater management. You know, the plant species, those are typically going to be where surface water runoff is going to go to. If there's any gasoline present in that surface water runoff, what plant species do we need to put there that would actually remediate it and deal with that environmental impact? So we have this database of gasoline tolerant or gasoline remediating species that I'm willing to share. I did not include it in the actual document itself, but I am willing to share it. So if anybody's interested in that particular database, then please send me an email. My email contact is part of the slide pack that is being presented. The other part, the last one listed on slide 38, is a database that is basically a literature reference database that was compiled when I first started in the technology back in 1999. So the biggest problem is it's dated. It's, you know, over a decade old. It is incorporated into the document as Appendix B. But it basically covers different types of contaminants, metals, rads, nutrients, petroleum, chlorinated compounds, and pesticides, as well as the things that Ellie talked about water usage, so how much water can a plant transpire, and its rain interception capacity, so, you know, what percentage of that rainfall is actually being captured, does it actually infiltrate into the ground. Those are included in this literature database that has actually been incorporated as Appendix B in the document itself. So moving on to slide 39, you know, this step, you're assuming that you have, you know, species that are viable. They may not be, you know, may not be what you end up at the site with, but are at least viable based on using that earlier decision tree, figure 2.1, that says, okay, my existing species work, my database of species are, you know, so I have something to work with at this point. This decision tree, and I don't want you to read it on this particular slide, it's way too small. Go to the document, it's much more detailed. In fact, every single box that's in this decision tree has a small paragraph behind it explaining what is the question that it's asking and how do you answer it. So again, a lot more detail is contained within the document itself. I would advise everybody to go there. The only thing that I'll talk about in this particular slide, as well as the next couple slides, is what do the symbols mean? You know, so at the bottom of the decision tree, you got the green go circles and the red stop signs. So basically, again, the red stop signs, you know, again, we don't oversell the technology. We tell you when this technology is no longer applicable. Tell you what, you know, if there's some condition out there that says, Phyto's not your answer, go look somewhere else, that's what those stop signs are telling you. The go symbols in this particular one are basically telling you either go to a, you know, the next decision tree, which at the next slide on slide 40 is the next decision tree. It's telling you, okay, go to the groundwater decision tree, or go to the soil sediment decision tree, go to the riparian buffer decision tree, go to the ITRC's constructed wetlands document, because, you know, that might be the better application that you're looking for. So really, this is kind of a roadmap of, you know, where do you go next for looking at, you know, a particular application of FIDO. The only other symbol I'll talk about is yield on this slide. That's basically a, you know, a condition that you have to consider before you make your next, before you go to the next question in the decision tree. So there's a factor that you have to consider and keep in the back of your mind before you can make your final evaluation. Just simply makes you stop and think about something before you proceed. Moving on to slide 40, this is figure 2.3. This is a groundwater decision tree, which, again, don't read here. Go to, you know, the actual document itself. And basically what this decision tree is taking is, you know, you've done your site assessment. You have all this information that is now, you know, you need to then feed into this decision tree to figure out is FIDO applicable to my groundwater situation at the site. And at the bottom of this decision tree, it tells you, okay, you're really looking at a tree hydraulic barrier, you know, so you can only really plant in clean groundwater and you're just controlling hydraulic at that point. Or you could actually plant in the impacted zone, so it's really going to be a FIDO remediation tree stand. Again, the stop sign is you're out, and you can see there's actually several ways to get out of this decision tree to a stop sign. Again, try not to oversell the technology. But there's also all kinds of ways you can get to, you know, how do you, you know, that a tree hydraulic barrier is applicable for your site, or a FIDO remediation tree stand is applicable for your site. Again, the yield signs are, again, think about this other factor before you continue on with the next decision point. Similarly, on slide 41, this is a soil sediment decision tree, very same symbols associated with it. In this case, though, you're coming to the decision about whether it's a FIDO stabilization application or is it a FIDO remediation application. And, again, that's the two different green circle symbols on there. And, again, stop sign, yield sign, kind of very similar to the previous decision trees. On slide 42, this is the riparian zone decision tree, which is figure 2.5 in the document. This one was kind of a shortcut decision tree, if you will. Really, what a riparian transition is, it's basically going from an upland to a wetland. And when you're at an upland side, and if it's contamination in the groundwater, then really you just need to look at the groundwater decision tree. If it's a, you know, upland area, but it's runoff, then maybe you need to look at the soil sediment decision tree. And similarly at the you know, the wetland end of it, basically where the water, you know, daylights at the surface. Again, it depends on, you know, typically you're going to look at the soil sediment decision tree in that case, but in some cases you may be looking at the groundwater as well. And really that's all this particular decision tree tells you is actually to go back to either the soil sediment one or the groundwater one and make your decision based on that. Moving on to slide 43, in addition to kind of that technical evaluation that I just went through with the decision trees, there are some other regulatory decision factors, things like feasibility, fate and transport, and treatability studies. I did touch on this a little earlier in terms of the fate and transport. One of the big questions that always comes up, and it, you know, comes up all the time, in fact, is if I'm moving a contaminant from the subsurface, whether that's from soil or groundwater, and it's getting into the plant tissues, is that now creating a, you know, one, is that transferring media? Well, and two, is that creating an exposure pathway? In other words, there's insects or, you know, animals that come and eat that vegetation. Is that now an issue associated with, you know, moving the contaminant into the plant, you know, from the soil into the plant? Well, one way to address that is simply doing bench studies and investigating where is the contaminant ending up in the soil-plant atmosphere continuum itself. Maybe it's being, you know, maybe the plant is just simply acting as a conduit, moving it from the soil into the atmosphere. That's media switching, so that's not necessarily a good thing, but it will help you answer that question if you do the proper bench scale study. Similarly, if it is getting sequestered in the plant, then you can figure out what kind of concentrations does it get to. There have been studies where you can, you know, concentrate a contaminant into a plant and then expose different herbivores to that plant. and do all kinds of studies looking at is there any transfer into, you know, a potential receptor. Again, these types of studies generally are going to be needed to some extent. If nothing else, you know, one of the things that helps helps you do is figure out what are the growth conditions that are optimal for that plant. Typical setup and design of these, you know, it can be any scale, laboratory, greenhouse, to even a small-scale field study. It could also be hydroponic, pot-based, or test plots out on the site. But generally what we recommend is try to duplicate the site conditions as much as possible, so that's things like the climate. You know, so certainly if you do it at the test site or at the field site, you know, the climate conditions are identical to, you know, the site itself. And that would be things like the temperature, sunlight, precipitation, and so on. Also try to replicate the soil conditions. So, you know, if you can use soil and water that you collect from the site in your greenhouse or in your pot study or whatever scale you're using, try to replicate all the conditions as you can. One of the advantages of doing these is you can test all kinds of conditions fairly quickly that you couldn't do in the field. And really, you know, from my perspective, it's, you know, the lessons you learn from that small-scale bench study or whatever actually leads to long-term cost savings overall. Because, you know, for example, simply just knowing how much irrigation is required for a plant, you can figure that out pretty easily in a lab study, translates pretty quickly into, you know, how to operate and maintain your system in the site at a full scale, and actually can lead you to a lot of cost savings overall. So it actually pays for itself eventually. So I do recommend doing these. The other big advantage is you can actually do this during the dormant part of the year, so winter in the northern climates. You can actually do these in a lab setting or a greenhouse setting, conduct these experiments, get a lot of good data, good information that you will then apply in the field in the, you know, when you go out and actually plant. Moving on to slide 44, another set of decision factors that typically have to be considered when you're selecting the remedy is the stakeholder decision factors. And this is discussed in section 234 of the document. One of the things that I'll mention is basically a lot of these end up being the same things that Chris mentioned during the advantages and limitations part of his portion of the talk. Things like aesthetics, things like environmental footprint, you know, so your carbon footprint, sustainability. You know, the timing, you know, Chris mentioned a couple ways timing comes into play, you know, seasonality as well as the long-term application of a technology. Those types of things are generally going to be the same factors that stakeholders are going to be concerned with. So in a way, you know, the advantages and limitations piece of that does fit in very well into figuring out how well stakeholders will or will not accept a technology, in particular FIDO, which has some unique qualities to it that will need to go through this decision process. On slide 45, the last thing we do talk about in terms of the remedy selection are the economic decision factors. And two parts of that really are what are the costs of a project. And we, in the document itself, we really kind of struggled with that because every project is unique. So the costs associated with those projects are unique as well. So instead of coming up with some single table that says here is all the project costs and this is what it will take to implement a technology, you know, apply the technology, we actually interspersed all the cost information into the remainder of the document. So how much does it take to, you know, conduct a feasibility study? You know, something you may have to do for a site, maybe you don't have to do for a site. Same thing with the design and implementation. So there's capital associated with it. How much does the plant cost, you know, stock cost? How much does the machinery cost to rent to implement, to actually install the system, and so on. So all that cost information is actually, you know, interspersed with the rest of the document, so I'll refer to it there. The other piece that is actually more talked about in Section 235 is really how do you compare FIDO on an economic basis to other technologies that are maybe just as applicable at your site. A good example of that would be a pumpetreat system versus a FIDO hydraulic system. You know, they basically both will control groundwater. There's a treatment associated with it. And how do you now compare those two technologies into, you know, to be able to assess which one to go with? One of the things, you could do it on a quantitative basis. Basically, that would be looking at the capital cost, the time to implement, the labor associated with it, the long-term operation and maintenance, very quantitative numbers associated with that. But then there's also some semi-quantitative things associated with getting that technology implemented. An example I use oftentimes is the community acceptance part of it. You know how much a meeting would cost in terms of going out to a public meeting, renting the space, getting the presentation materials ready and so on. That, there's a cost associated with that. That's pretty quantitative in itself. But you don't know how many meetings it will actually take to get you to that agreement. So that's the semi-quantitative part of that. So things like that, come into play, and the document itself tells you how to evaluate those to make sure that they're even across the board when you're doing your evaluation of the Pumatree system versus the Fido system. And then, again, there's the completely qualitative factors, things like aesthetics. How important is aesthetics to the community? How do you put a value on that? Again, the document itself, it actually steals from the Ecological Land Reuse ITRC document, or the ECO-1 document, in terms of how to do this evaluation. So actually, the bigger description of how to do the evaluation is really contained in the ECO-1 document, so I'll refer everybody to that. But we use that same type of process in this FIDO document to explain how do you compare this technology, FIDO, versus the other options that you have at your, at your disposal. So, moving on to slide 46. This is the first slide within the design and implementation step. So, if you look at that five-box diagram at the bottom right, this is the first time the design and implementation box has been highlighted. And one of the things that we talk about in design and implementation is planning up front and things like safety. You can plan a lot of that up front. So, safety first. Table 2.2.7 in the document itself covers a whole host of hazards or hazardous conditions that are associated with biotechnology systems. Now, certainly things like biohazards are going to be present at any site. Well cap could have a black widow hiding under it, and that's a biohazard. But the point of the phytotechnology document is you are creating an ecology, which means you are attracting biological inhabitants to that habitat. So you're actually potentially increasing your biohazard potential at your site. You're going to be attracting insects. You're going to be attracting animals. You're going to be attracting nuisance vegetation at your site. The document itself, Table 2.7 in particular, not only identifies what those hazards or hazardous conditions might be, but even better, offers the potential solutions to deal with it. So again, at the beginning of design implementation, we want to make sure that safety comes first. So all the different things that you're going to be dealing with in a FIDO system are discussed in the design implementation section, and then it actually offers solutions how to deal with it. One of the ones I like to talk about in kind of a case study application was went to a community and presented our list of species that we are proposing for the FIDO system at the site, and it didn't come up during the actual, community meeting itself, but somebody came up to me afterward and said, well, I'm allergic to this particular species. I wonder if there's some other substitute we could use. Had I gone out there and not talked to that person beforehand or not even considered that as a potential problem, I could have planted that out of the site. They could have had, some allergic reaction to it that then would have been a bigger issue associated with it than, the actual contamination itself. But again, planning that up front, when you go through and present this type of information to a community, it's good to list the species out there just so everybody knows what you're planting at the site. I often get the questions about, cottonwoods. The cotton that actually comes from cottonwood can cause a lot of problems with HVAC units, air conditioning units, and so on when the cotton comes and gets released by the plant. Something else you can plan for by your plant selection process, simply because you can plant non-cotton-forming cottonwoods. There are such a thing out there. It's actually been bred that way. So, again, things you need to think about up front can cause some issues in terms of the implementation later on. But again, if you can plan it up front, that's what we recommend. Moving on to slide 47, there's all kinds of models that are available out there to help you predict, how well your system will do, how long it will take, what the performance might be in the coming future. Things like the water balance of the system. There are very complex models out there. My recommendation is look for something simple, mainly because, climate is almost impossible to predict. And really that help, you know, does control a lot of how well a system will grow. So keep it simple, you know, that the KISS philosophy, if you will. You can also, you know, come up with, you know, meteorological-based data that will, you know, you can get from data loggers or your local meteorological station that can then feed into a larger model. There are plant-specific models out there, phytoextraction in particular. The transpiration stream concentration factor as well as the root concentration factor are kind of two phytospecific parameters that are that have been published out there, is basically telling you the concentration of the contaminant that's present in the plant versus outside of the plant. And it can give you an idea of how well that, you know, the uptake of a contaminant is occurring. And then really just simple attenuation factors, zero order or first order. In a way, it's kind of a green box technology. Don't necessarily care how the attenuation is occurring as long as it is. And this, you know, the attenuation factors, the zero order or first order rate constants, can give you an idea of how well that's performing. Now, in addition, models are also good, of course, not just for predicting the future, but for tracking how well it's doing in terms of the operation and maintenance of the system. So that's why that operation and maintenance and monitoring box in the five-box diagram is actually highlighted as well. Another type of modeling that you could do is simply empirical-based equations. The particular graph on slide 48 is figure 2.6 in the document. This is just an example that's used in the document itself. Basically, looking at the rate of water uptake or water usage defined by VT in the diagram in liters per day based on a surrogate of growth, if you will, the basal trunk area of a tree. This is measured through what are called sap flow sensors. That's the picture on the right. We'll cover this a little more in the operation and maintenance and monitoring section, but basically it's a pair of thermocouples. One has a heating source, and as sap flows moves past it, it's dissipating that heat measured by the thermocouples. So the rate of heat dissipation is telling you how much liquid is moving by it, which then can be translated basically into the water that's passing through the tree. This is, again, is very specific. It's a case study within the document. It's, you know, for poplar species growing in USDA plant hardiness zone 5B to 6A. So don't go and take this graph and apply it out in California or up in Alaska or, you know, in Hawaii or wherever. It's not going to work there. It's, you know, it won't give you the right information. This is very specific to the climate zone that it's in and very specific to the species. Incidentally, the USDA plant hardiness zone, if you want to find a nice map of that, I would, you know, just simply Google those terms, USDA plant hardiness zone, and you'll come up with all kinds of nice pictures of different, you know, what the plant hardiness zones are. The other option is the USDA, Department of Agriculture, has a plants national database. Do a Google search on that. Actually, it's actually one of the links at the end of this talk as well. The plants national database actually contains all the information you would ever want to know about growing plants, what are suitable climate zones, what's the suitable growth conditions. It is one of the best references I can refer anybody to in terms of figuring out what is the best species or what are the conditions that are needed for suitability. Back to that previous slide that I talked about, the suitability factors that you will look at, hardiness, growth conditions, nutrient requirements, brooding depth, water usage, all of those things are contained within the USDA plant hardiness zone, hardiness database. Moving on to slide 49, another part of design and implementation is the infrastructure and site preparation. This is section 2.4.2 in the document. And really what it's talking about there is, you know, the things like irrigation systems. You certainly want to design that before you put your trees in, because afterwards it's kind of a pain to put in an irrigation system after you have planted your site. Same thing with on-site fencing and security, as well as soil preparation. You really want to be able to prepare your soil up front before you plant. Again, it's much difficult afterwards. The other thing, for the on-site access, fencing, and security, I'm not just talking about trespassers from a two-legged standpoint. I'm also talking about the four-legged type. One of the things that I mentioned earlier is, you know, you are creating an ecology, which means you will attract wildlife. The wildlife is going to be so grateful that they'll come and chew down your plants. And if they do that, of course, your phytosystem's got some problems. So what do you do to deal with that? There's different types of fencing, The picture on the bottom right is kind of an electrical fence. That's an extreme condition that you might have to deal with, but it, you know, it's a viable option. Kind of the picture on the left where the deer basically gives you an idea of some of the things you might deal with. You know, you plant trees, one of the things deer love to come do, particularly the males, is come and rub their antlers against it to knock off the felt. Well, that, you know, that can completely kill a tree as well. So you need to deal with that. And again, section 242 in the document actually talks about how to deal with those things. One of the things that we, you know, that can't do justice to in this 2 hours, 15 minute talk is the detail that we actually get to in the document. So again, absolutely go to the document for, you know, as a resource or a reference to all this information. The level of detail that we can talk about here is not as in-depth. And kind of the next two or three slides actually talk to a bit of that detail just to give an example of it. This is actually one of my sites. They're inside the picture on the left is basically within the tank berm of an old above-ground storage tank, or an AST. We had a pipeline release, and that pipeline that's actually shown in the picture itself basically had, you know, refined petroleum products spread out, you know, into the tank berm area. Of course, some of that seeped into the soil, and really that's the environmental issue that we're dealing with. One of the issues that you will always deal with, particularly at industrial sites, is this, quote, soil quality. It's not really soil. So it gets back to that agronomic and soil condition criteria or site assessment piece that I talked about earlier. Typically, what you're looking at in industrial facilities is gravel, fill content. In terms of petroleum sites, maybe old, weathered, heavy hydrocarbon material. It's not really natural organic matter. There's no soil moisture or nutrient content associated with it. And that picture on the bottom right is kind of an overhead view of the, you know, of an area within that tank berm area, kind of just illustrating that point, that it's really not soil. I love that this particular picture, though, because you also have plants growing in it. And again, it gets back to that plant selection piece where the first thing you want to do, actually the site assessment piece, was to assess your existing vegetation. Mother Nature's telling me there's a plant species that can either, absolutely tolerate that because it's growing. And, maybe that's a point to start with in terms of what do I need to plant at the site in the future. This particular plant was identified as Doncus carota. That's the scientific name. It's known as wild carrot in some parts of the U.S. It's known as Queen's Anvilace in other parts of the U.S. So again, that gets, you know, the reason why you want to get multiple names to the plant species, Doncus carota being the scientific name, is the constant of that. And in essence, it told me that there are certain, you know, not just Doncus carota in itself, but what are some of the other types of species that might grow there. You know, in other words, what kind of ecosystem supports Doncus carota? It happens to be a mesic prairie species, so that's where I looked and found other species that might be applicable at this particular site. So again, it can be used as an indicator of things that you might use at your site in the future. Moving on to slide 51, the other things you'll deal with at a lot of industrial or contaminated sites is soil compaction. And again, this is a lot more detailed description in this particular case study than we can get to in the remainder of this talk, but again, it illustrates how much detail is really in the document. This is figure 2.7 in the document itself, and it's, basically both of these figures are in that, in figure 2.7. I like to talk about the picture as opposed to the graph, or the graph on the left. I like to talk about the picture. Basically what this is showing is, you know, the area that has inter-road traffic means there's high soil compaction there. This is a typical farm field, frankly. When you have large equipment running over this area where inter-road traffic is, it compacts the soil so tightly that roots can't penetrate it anymore. And in the left side of that picture, you can see an area that says no traffic. That's where roots tend to proliferate. The picture itself is a little deceiving in the sense that there is a plow pan that forms under the entire site where you have heavy machinery compacting that soil over time. The plow pan actually does restricts root penetration as well. But what you see in the picture is if you take a deep harrow, which is a farm implementation that basically scrapes deeper than 18 inches into the subsurface, you can break up that plow pan, and once you do that, that's where you get this proliferation of roots into the subsoil. So the picture itself is actually after you've done the deep harrowing and have broken up that plow pan. You can see the proliferation of roots that you can get below that plow pan, assuming you can break it up in the first place. So again, it kind of gives you an idea of some of the, again, back to the site assessment piece. If you know how compacted your soil is, it then dictates, okay, now I need to, procure a piece of a deep harrowing equipment out there to be able to break up the plow pan that I will then need it during the implementation stage of the project. Moving on to slide 52, and again, this is actually a continuation of the case study itself, is now that we know the condition of the soils, it doesn't have a lot of nutrient content, doesn't hold moisture, it's got this plow pan issue that we're dealing with. What do you need to do, amend your soil with in order to make it more fertile? Different types of fertilizers, different types of, lime and gypsum, sulfur, those types of things that you can add to the soil. Compost is a very good, moisture retention, as well as organic matter content. And those types of things are covered in Table 2.9 of the document in terms of what do you amend the soil with and how, well, let me take a step back. What kind of soil condition do you have or the effect that you're trying to get, and what kind of soil amendment do you use to get that effect? So again, if you have acidic soil, maybe you need to add some lime, help, change that pH back to a more neutral condition. Or on the other extreme, alkalinity, maybe gypsum or something, a sulfur-based compound is something you need to be able to apply into your field to, again, put the pH back to neutral. And so on. So, Table 2.9 kind of gives you some quick ideas of what kind of amendments do you need to have in order to get your soil to a more fertile condition. Now, one of the things I will recommend is contact your USDA Agricultural Extension Service agent. All counties have them. Basically, they'll examine your soil. You got to let them know that it might have contaminants in it, and they may or may not be able to accept it based on that. But they're a good place to start in terms of figuring out what's the soil condition that I'm dealing with. What do I need to add in order to make that soil even better for plant growth? That's what they'll do, is tell you what you can add. So again, go to the U.S. Agricultural Extension Service agent to get that information. Moving on to slide 53, I mentioned this just before, is, organic matter is very important for industrial sites in particular where there's no natural organic matter typically present in the soil. Tables 210 and 211 kind of get to some different ideas or different organic matter materials, compost materials, and the carbon-nitrogen ratio that's associated with them. Table 210, I believe, is basically the compost and the carbon-nitrogen ratio that's associated with each of those. Then Table 211 is that target ratio box at the bottom right, basically giving you a range of carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. NPK are the three primary nutrients needed for plant growth. Now, they're not the only ones. Again, the table that Chris referenced very early on has the 13 essential plant nutrients, NPK being the primary ones, macronutrients. But I should mention the carbon ratio that you're talking about here. So the ratios that are shown in this are actually based on the total carbon present at the site. So whatever natural organic matter plus the anthropogenic carbon that's present from the contaminant itself needs to be included in that 100 part of that ratio. So you add both of those two parts together, the natural and the anthropogenic, and then calculate your NPK ratios based on that point, that total carbon. The picture itself in slide 53 is basically the same perspective as the previous one, showing you that, the plant, the area that was impacted has been, the soil has been amended and the actual plants have been planted at the site. So the implementation took place, I don't have the graph in here in this particular slide pack, but the concentration reduction has reduced, of the petroleum compounds has reduced 3 to 4, in some cases 5 orders of magnitude, depending on which contaminant you're talking about. It's not a slide in the presentation itself, but it gives you an idea of the ability of the use of phyto to implement and the things that you actually need to deal with in order to truly implement the technology. Another part of the design and implementation is the plant stock itself. This is a bit misleading in the sense that on slide 54, which is 243 in the document, plant selection, plant stock. What we mean here is not selecting species, but selecting a form of the plant. If you're talking ground covers, is that seed? Is it bare-rooted? Is it plugs? Or is it potted stock? You know, so it comes in different commercial forms. Similarly, trees come in, you know, whips and poles, bare-rooted, potted, bald, and burlap. That's what the B&B stands for. And then riparian transitions also, you know, can be any combination of those again. So there is, you know, there are basically advantages and disadvantages to each of those different types of stock, size being one of them. So, you know, if you've got, you know, a couple thousand trees to plant and you want bald and burlap, that's a lot of truckloads of trees that you've got to bring to the site. That's a management, you know, condition that you have to deal with. On the other hand, if you can plant whips and poles, you know, that's a bundle of sticks. Really, that's what it looks like. And certainly different management required in order to transport that and store it at the site. So again, some of those things are covered in section 243 of the document. Just, you know, the cost implications, commercial availability, another issue that you'll have to deal with. Not all, you know, nurseries are going to have 1,000 bald and burlap poplar trees. They're probably going to have 1,000 whips and poles, but they're not going to have them as large potted stock. It just takes too much space for them to deal with. A couple of rules of thumb are shown on the right. One, when you're going through your plant selection, actually this is really more species selection. One is don't select just one species. Try to avoid the monoculture. The big reason for that is, you know, if you get a disease and it wipes out, you know, basically it'll wipe out your entire planting. As opposed to if you have a mixture of species, that disease is probably only going to affect one of those species and not all of them. So you actually have a backup built in, if you will. Another thing that we do recommend, or kind of as a rule of thumb, is to select climax species also in your mixture of species. Climax being those that will take over in time. You know, poplars, you know, those plants in the Salicaceae family that Ellie mentioned, poplars, willows, cottonwoods, and so on, are actually considered, quote, short-lived species. They may live 20, 30 years short for trees. Climax species might be things like oaks or cypresses, something that live 200 or 300 years. And if you're looking at remediation or eventually the closure of your site might be an ecological reuse or, you know, some return to a natural setting, you want those climax species in time because, in, again, 20, 30 years, all the poplars and willows are going to die off. The climax species will take 20 or 30 years to mature, will then take over the long-term remediation, if you will, of the site after those quick-lived species are gone. And then the other major rule of thumb, and this actually gets back to plant selection, plant stock, is you want to typically target the planting at the right time of the year. In the northern climates, that's typically late winter, early spring. There's also a fall planting that you could do as well, but it's generally not as good as the, at least in my experience, the late winter, early spring typically is the better time to plant. So what that means in terms of getting prepared for that time is when do you order the plant stock? You actually have to order it 4 months in advance. So if you're looking for a project to do in 2011, you've already missed the planting season, and it's mainly because you haven't ordered your stock yet. Now, you know, it's very, it'd be very difficult to find appropriate stock, 1,000 trees, if you will, right now. But if you ordered it back in December, you would have been able to secure that stock at that time. So again, a very important rule of thumb is, you know, order your stock at the appropriate time, plan out when you're actually going to be out and planting in the field. Moving on to slide 55, section 243 of the document covers planting methods. How do you actually install these things? And again, it's going to depend on the stock, you know, so if it's seed, there's, you know, different ways of planting seed. If it's plugs, there are different ways to plant plugs. And moving on to slide 56, you know, same thing for trees. Different planting methods for trees depending on what kind of stock. I would say 90% of the plantings that I've seen for Fido typically are going to use, you know, whips or poles in the Salicaceae family. That's, you know, it's not 100% by any means, but in general, when you get dealing with whips or poles, there's a particular type of planting method that's covered on slide 56. And that's really through the bore, what, you know, creating bore holes down to the target zone that you're looking for. The steps that are shown, that are numbered here, 1 through 6, are the steps that you will actually go through. First, do your contouring and mounding of your site. So you want to promote runoff So you might, you know, actually build some mounding associated with your where you're going to be planting to shed water off of it so that there isn't water infiltrating in. You're actually promoting runoff because if your target is groundwater, you want the roots to focus on groundwater, not on that rainwater that just fell on your site. That defeats the purpose. So contouring and mounding is the first step. You can create boreholes down to that groundwater and then, you know, and eventually backfill it with root-conducive medium. So you're creating a root conduit, if you will. One of the advantages of the Salicaceae family is you can do what's called deep planting of them. You could take a 10-foot pole. Again, it looks exactly like a stick because that's what it is. You can plant 9 feet of that stick into the ground and have only 1 foot emerge above ground. That 1 foot that's above ground will produce the branches and leaves. The 9 feet that's underground will produce a root system that's actually already 9 feet below ground. That's the big advantage of it. Because otherwise, if you're planting everything at the surface, it's going to take you 2 years to grow 9 feet down into the subsurface. Well, here you're planting from day one all the way down to 9 feet. It's already taken 2 years off your timeline. That's the big advantage of Salicaceae, and that's why 90% of the applications focus on that particular family of trees. You can't do it with all kinds of different other tree species. It's very specific to Salicaceae and also maybe a few others that are out there, but, you know, certainly couldn't do this for a, you know, an oak tree, for example. You will kill the oak if you do it that way. But, you know, the deep planting gives you some advantages. Another way to help you is step four is install a multi-level drip irrigation system. That's kind of shown in the light blue lines or they're representing tubes that you install into the subsurface. What you want to do is train the roots to go deeper and deeper over time. So you would irrigate at the shallow tube first, subsequent years irrigate at the intermediate tube, and then final last year you would irrigate only at the bottom tube. And that way the roots actually chase that water over time, grow the root system down to the depth that you're targeting. Another option is step five is a design backfill. Typically, you know, if you create a borehole, either you can't put the cuttings back in because of regulatory requirements, or if you can put the cuttings back in, I would mix in nutrients or soil amendments that will help make the conduit, if you will, much more root conducive for growth, for the roots to actually grow into. And then finally, you can actually place landscape tarp over the site. That helps reduce infiltration, provide some protection as well, and so on. And again, promotes the roots to actually go deeper into the subsurface. Slide 57, there's hybrid methods associated with that. There's, you know, the trenching method shown on the left, basically doing the same thing as the boreholes are, except you're cutting a long trench instead. There's some advantages to that. It's much quicker than punching a bunch of holes. The disadvantage is you do create more cuttings. And then there's a hybrid of that shown in the schematic on the right. Basically, you're trenching to a certain depth and then boreholes deeper beyond that. Again, advantages, disadvantages associated with that. Moving on to slide 58, this is the first of the operation and maintenance. One of the things you will have to do is maintain plant nutrition or the health of the plants. So fertilizing and soil amendments, things that you may have to reapply, at a periodic basis, maybe annually. I'll refer you back to the previous tables, 2.9 through 2.11, which were basically the soil amendment tables, compost, nutrient, different types of nutrients for different effects and so on. And also, rule of thumb, target 1 to 2 inches a week, including precipitation. So again, you want to be able to monitor the amount of water that's falling in the site from precipitation, and then supplement that through your irrigation system that you installed, in order to meet that 1 to 2 inches per week, target. Moving on to slide 59, one of the things, this is the field of dreams slide, as I call it. If you build it, they will come. And that is no doubt. It's either going to be insects or larger animals. The picture on the right is kind of an illustration of what they could do. The bottom right, you can't see it in the picture, but there's actually a creek downstream or down gradient of this tree stand that was planted. Well, the beaver that, basically was being protected by the phytosystem was so grateful it came out and chewed down all the trees to use for itself. Fortunately, again, another very nice feature of the Salicaceae family is you can coppice a Salicaceae tree and it'll actually regrow from the stump. Fortunately, at this site, this was actually a site in Texas, in Ellis State, where 3 years later you couldn't tell which tree had been cut down by the beaver and which didn't, because they're, one, very rapidly growing, and two, you know, they can regrow from the stump, the Salicaceae family. Again, not all species or not all families of trees will do this, but it's a nice one for the Salicaceae family as well. And all kinds of different pests that you'll deal with, you know, tent caterpillars, herbivores, insects, Canadian geese, and so on. Things that, again, not just in the planting stage, but long-term operation and maintenance, you'll need to deal with this as well. Ways of dealing with the grateful critters are covered on page 60, slide 60, which is 251 in the document. Electric fencing that I mentioned earlier. The picture on the bottom left is kind of an interesting looking picture. It's basically a bunch of poplar whips that were just planted, and then the blue things around it are trunk guards. So it prevents deer or voles or other small rodents coming in and chewing on the green stems, if you will, of the tree, and actually are able to help protect the plant from those critters. The bottom right is kind of an interesting concept, is basically promoting natural selection, if you will. You know, a way of controlling rodents is to put in hawk poles, you know, promote the natural, you know, predatory nature of hawks to control rodents in your planted site. It's a natural way of doing it. Another thing that is available out there are different insecticides or pesticides. BT spray is often considered because it's supposedly environmentally friendly. It's a Bacillus thuringiensis that is used to control insects. You know, there's a lot of debate about whether it is or isn't environmentally damaging. But again, a lot of different herbivores or herbicides and pesticides are available. Again, one thing you could do is consult an agronomist or a tree specialist or, you know, a local ag extension service agent in order to look at what kind of insecticides or pesticides might be useful. Another operation and maintenance issue that you deal with, and I kind of alluded to this earlier during the question and answer, is the handling and disposal of harvested material. Slide 61. This particular example is the Chinese brake fern, which is known to hyperaccumulate arsenic. Some of the numbers that you can see in the bullet, the, you know, part per million level, you know, up to 1,500 parts per million in the site soil, but in the plant is up to 2% of the dry weight of the plant material. So a high concentration of arsenic is now present in the plant. Harvesting, you know, that material then becomes a handling and disposal issue because potentially it's a, you know, hazardous material at that point. The other complication associated with this particular brake fern, Pteris vittata, is that in the living plant it's arsenic-3, but when it's harvested, it actually rapidly converts into the more toxic form of arsenic-5. So again, it starts becoming a handling issue associated with this particular material. Section 251 of the document discusses the handling and disposal issues that you may potentially face, and also provides what you need to do in order to address those. Moving on to slide 62, the terrestrial plant growth, you know, again, you'll need to monitor the growth conditions that your plants are growing in. That's the climate conditions, and it's also the canopy of the system itself. Things like canopy structure, the height of it, the trunk girth, and moving on to slide 63 is the canopy development in terms of the light, the leaf area index, or LAI. This is basically the canopy closure. One of the things associated with evapotranspiration in particular is once the canopy reaches 100% closure, in other words, all the sunlight is being captured, you're really not going to get a lot more evapotranspiration occurring from the system. Basically, the energy driving that evapotranspiration is the solar radiation. So if you're capturing all that solar radiation by the canopy, there's not much more that can be, there's not much more energy driving additional pumping. Leaf area index is a measure of canopy closure, LAI. Typically 3 to 4 is, you know, the number you'll get for most canopies. Some species it can be higher, some species it can be lower. And you measure that through a photosynthetically active radiation sensor, or a PAR sensor, which is specifically tuned to the photosynthetically active radiation range of the EM spectrum. Another way of measuring it is area coverage is basically, you know, the cheap way of doing it is just simply waiting till it's noon on a sunny day and seeing how much area is actually shaded and how much isn't. That's basically telling you the area coverage. And the more shading that you have, the more you know that the radiation is being captured. Another thing that you may need to monitor for is on slide 64. This is the root penetration or root growth that's associated with your system. There's all different kinds of ways for monitoring that, from the brute force methods of digging up a tree, basically very detrimental to the tree itself. You'll kill that tree. But it can tell you a lot of things about where the roots are growing. The picture on the right is kind of an illustration of that. You can see the bucket in the foreground of that picture. The PVC tube is basically one of the irrigation tubes that is associated with that. It's also a breather tube that allows oxygen exchange to occur. And basically, it shows you where the roots are growing within the actual borehole itself. You can also use clear plastic rhizotron tubes instead of a white PVC tube. Use a rhizotron tube in clear plastic and put a downhole camera into it, a plumber's camera, if you will. And kind of, you could use that to identify where the roots are and where the roots aren't. There's another method using tracer compounds or the actual contaminant that you might be looking for. The T-shaped tool that's kind of in the bottom center of the slide itself is a trunk coring tool that's very common in forestry. Basically, you can take a core out and put it in a bore vial, which is that picture just right of the T-shaped tool, and then measure the headspace gas that's coming off of it. So if you've got a volatile compound that you know is in your groundwater, and it happens, and you take a trunk core and you find it in the headspace emanating from that trunk core, you know that the tree is actually tapping into the groundwater that you're looking for. Another, relatively new method that's out there is looking at stable water isotopes. The delta D value, the heavy water to regular water that's present in the Beto zone is going to be different than what's in the groundwater. And basically the xylem sap delta D value will be a number in between those two extremes. And again, it can tell you an idea whether the xylem sap, basically the water that is, taken up from the root zone into the tree, is actually coming from the Beto zone or is it coming from the groundwater itself. One of the things that we do talk about quite a bit in the document is on slide 65, and this is the lines of evidence slide in the document. Primary line of evidence for any remediation, including phyto, and that's the point of this, is the concentration reduction associated with the remediation itself, regardless of what the technology is. So if you get good concentration reduction, that is probably really the only evidence you need. All the other evidence that we talk about in the document is really secondary evidence. It's how to measure things in the tree or how to measure the tree growth. That's all secondary lines of evidence. If you've got good concentration trends, which is kind of shown on slide 65 for a small case study that I talk about in the document, that's all you really need. The actual slide 65 is basically showing the trend graph of MTBE and gasoline range organics over time. And, when we implemented the phyto back in mid-2004, basically the concentrations were elevated compared to mid-2008 when they were reduced over time. The couple, maroon-colored lines basically were some things that were going on at the site itself. We actually had proposed it back in at the end of 2006, but phyto got rejected because the concentration reduction at the time wasn't good enough. At the time, after that, we, started to look at an alternative of an ozone sparging system. We never operated it because by the time we got all the planning for the ozone sparging done, the concentrations from the phyto system were still, the phyto was still working, actually reduced the concentrations to an acceptable level. So the regulatory agency at the time ended up accepting the phyto application instead of the alternative that we had proposed. And again, it kind of gets to two points. One, again, primary lines of evidence, concentration reduction. If you can show a good concentration reduction, that's really all you need to help convince, whoever needs convincing. The other piece of it is the time frame that's associated with the technology. Again, phyto is not your quick fix technology, nor will it ever be. It needs a few years to, one, grow and get the roots down to the target zone and actually do the implementing the remediation that you're trying to get to. But it does take some time for that to occur. So again, this is a longer term technology, And you have to give it the appropriate time in order to actually see the results. Slide 66, in addition to all the other technology or, you know, monitoring techniques that I talked about before, there are some other ones that we do touch on in the document quite a bit. Section 253 in the document, things like looking at the soil conditions. You know, one thing that the plants will do is they will affect the soil environment, soil moisture, microbiology, the geochemical characteristics of the soil. Also, there are monitoring techniques specific to phyto, like the sap flow sensors that I talked about a bit. Again, that's the thermocouples that you can drill into the trees and measure rate of heat dissipation, translate that into the rate of sap flow. There's actually another one, another technology very similar to that. It's basically called the collar type. The thermocouples are on the outside. You don't actually penetrate into the tree. There's advantages and disadvantages to that. The advantage, of course, is it's not as intrusive. The disadvantage is it's very limited on the diameter that you can use on the size of the tree. There's also plant tissue sampling. I talked about the trunk coring. Transpiration gas sampling. You basically can capture the transpiration gas. A couple things that you need to deal with is, you know, once you enclose a branch or, you know, a tree or a plant into an enclosure, humidity will shoot up to 100% and basically shut off your transpiration. So, you know, how do you deal with that? You can, you know, do an advective gas flow through there, basically promote the transpiration and so on. Again, all these things are covered in detail in Section 253 of the document. Moving on to Slide 67, one of the things that we do also promote in the long-term OM&M section is the contingency planning. You know, what do you do once, you know, after the system is installed, but you get, say, an infestation of, you know, some herbivore, or you get some natural disaster, a flood or a hurricane? I've had a site that's actually been impacted by 3 hurricanes now, and, you know, over a 10-year time frame, it's located in Louisiana. Unfortunately, the system has actually very well responded to those hurricanes. You know, it's not like it was in some cases it's a short-term impact. You know, maybe it's a few days for the system to recover. Other times, like a hurricane, it might be the remainder of the season or maybe a couple seasons before it actually fully recovers back to either the pre-hurricane condition or the pre-event conditions. Or it may take, some help to get there. You know, maybe some replanting or something, some other type of activity. The contingency planning section of the document kind of goes through those step-by-step things. The thing that you need to consider when you're doing the planning for, is this an event that you basically say the phyto system is completely destroyed and now you need to go somewhere else or, you know, need to look at a different technology, or is it a temporary setback? And you can actually, you know, weather that, you know, pun intended, weather that, you know, impact and then allow the phyto system to continue after a certain time frame. Another thing we do talk about in the contingency planning section is when do you go back and replant or not? Typically, if it's a plant here or a plant there at your site, you know, let Mother Nature, you know, natural selection take its course. Ultimately, you're looking at canopy closure, and, you know, the plants that are in that area will fill in that canopy without a problem. So don't go out and replant every single tree if it's a plant here and a plant there. If you've got an area, say 20% of your plantation that's all contiguous, maybe that's where you go in and replant that 20% area. And in a way, maybe that's telling you that's a hot spot. Maybe there's something going on in the soil or in the contamination that is preventing the plants from establishing there. So maybe that's helping you, again, to map out where, you know, some additional issues are associated with your site that you didn't know in the first place. So, again, use that information in kind of a site assessment mode as well. Finally, on slide 68, this is section 2.6 of the document. This is the closure portion, and really what we talk about in the closure of, you know, in this section of the document is really planning for closure up front in the beginning of it. So what are you going to use the site for in the long run? Are you going to use it for an ecological, land reuse, so a natural prairie land, which is kind of shown in that 20, where it says 20-year with the Wildlife Habitat Council certification. You know, that's one option for some of these contaminated sites is an ecological land redevelopment, turning it into a prairie land. A lot of my sites, we typically look at recreational facilities, things like golf courses. The two pictures on the right, two different golf courses that were established on former refineries. The reason why I like golf courses is they use a lot of plants and a lot of water features, so you can intermix constructed wetlands with terrestrial plantings. We actually worked with some golf course companies to actually look at the plant selection. You know, their biggest issues associated with plant, you know, planting at a golf course is nutrient loading and irrigation. You know, if they can reduce nutrient loading and irrigation, that's the biggest O&M cost that they're associated with. Well, it just so happens we look at deep-rooted species that can get their own irrigation and get their own nutrients. Well, you know, that helps address their long-term operation maintenance issues, also addresses our remediation issues at the same time. The one in the middle, the commercial retail site, one of the efforts I talked about in the plant database and Chris mentioned earlier as well is when we went and rebranded all retail sites, or whenever you go out and do landscaping, might as well look at, you know, species that could actually do good from a remediation standpoint up front. We call it phytoscaping, to kind of play on words of phytoremediation while landscaping. But basically, you look at your commercial plant species, your landscape quality species, and use those at your site if they're good for phyto, and apply that at your site as well. So with that, I will conclude, and I realize I have a lot of information very quickly, and I'll turn it back over to Ellie to give a quick wrap-up.
Yeah, great. Thank you, David, for that wealth of information. So in summary, we just hope with today's presentation that we've been able to at least demonstrate that these phytotechnologies really offer broad applicability for a whole host of situations and contaminants. But we really want to be careful, you know, we've been careful not to oversell the technology. We recognize that there are limitations to each of these particular applications. But this technology has also been around for many years, so its benefits and limitations are well known. And so the technology really shouldn't be considered innovative or emerging or new at this point. But I think in the future, it's just going to continue to be refined while at the same time broadened in its application. Also, we were hoping that we've been able to document the kind of the universal or user-friendly design of the document just by including a lot of tables and figures, and particularly the decision trees into the presentation, and also kind of how we have taken you through an entire project life cycle. Now, personally, as a regulator, I have to say I constantly find myself pulling this document off my bookshelf with every new phytotechnology proposal that comes across my desk for regulatory review. The decision trees in particular really keep me focused on just reviewing those basics as well as the goals of each proposal that I'm kind of looking at. So with that being said, I'm going to turn it back over to Juliana for some additional or final questions.
Thank you, Ellie. On slide 70, we aren't going to have time to address questions on the call today, but if you'd like to use that question mark button at the top of the slide, you can send in questions and we'll follow up after the training class. We now want to go to the links to additional resources page as well as to the feedback form. So you can select either of those areas on the slide. If you go to the links page, the way to get to the feedback is if you look to the left under the Clue and Sun, the third item down is that feedback button. We do ask that everybody on today's call provide feedback for us. We use the information and appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. Looking at the links page, item 1, download today's IPRC training. This is going to allow you to download the presentation that we've gone over during today's training class. In addition to what you've seen on the slides, there's more information available in the speaker's notes section of this downloaded version. Today's training introduced the IPRC Phytotechnology Technical and Regulatory Guidance and Decision Trees. This is the Phyto-3 document. We have a link that's going to take you over to the IPRC website where you can download a PDF of this document. And you've heard about the document during today's training class, and we do recommend that you review the document itself. We also have a link that's going to take you over to the remaining simulcast questions and answers from past classes. This is a location where we're going to post the questions that we get today, and then over the next couple of days, our instructors are going to respond to those questions. So if you are interested in looking at the current questions from today or looking at questions that we've addressed in past classes, you can go to that website. We do, in Section 2, have additional ITRC resources. We've mentioned several of these during today's training class, and I encourage you to look at the ITRC website to see what more resources are available. ITRC addresses a wide variety of topics, and we recommend you look through the ITRC website to see what is currently available and perhaps there are current teams that you may be interested in participating on. In Section 3, we have some additional websites and documents as well that you may find useful. We are out of time for today's training class, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap up. I'd like to thank our instructors and our participants for joining us today. As a reminder, please fill out those feedback forms. We appreciate you taking a few minutes to give us your feedback. For more information on ITRC, you can visit the ITRC website at www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.